Chinese International Broadcasting Station in Chongqing, operating on a frequency of 5,950 kilohertz in the 49-meter band.
Welcome.
Seven Japanese homes were shot down.
Four others were severely damaged
in a brisk air battle, which took place over the Changsha front as Chinese machines bombed and sprayed the retreating enemy land forces Thursday noon. Threats to a Chinese war community issued last night. One enemy plane was brought down and four others were damaged when the death fight broke out. The enemy aircraft then fled northward, says the communique. In the subsequent running battle, the Chinese brought down six more. Two Chinese planes were first to land at a point east of Changsha, but the members of the crew made a successful parachute landing. Japanese planes raided various parts of Hunan yesterday. Eight raiders bombed Hemyang junction of the Canton Hankou and Hemyang Guilin railways. Seven raided Shaoyang highway town in the central province, central part of the province. One reconnoitered Ling, railway and highway city near the Guangxi border. Wangxi. After yesterday, four Japanese planes, yesterday morning, reconnoitered Guilin, Guilin, and then machine gunned the southwestern suburbs of the city. It was learned that Changsha, Central News described the appearance of Changsha as living change. The city was almost entirely deserted, owing to the thoroughness with which the authorities had effected evacuation. Not only had unnecessary loss of life been thus avoided, but enemy espionage also frustrated. According to reliable information, the city of Yuebo, Y-O-C-H-O-W, in northern Hunan, is at present crowded with Japanese wounded soldiers from the front line. It is estimated that at least 7,000 Japanese wounded are now accommodated in various base hospitals in Yuebo. It is also learned that one train a day is leaving Yuebo for Wuhan, W-U-H-A-N, carrying wounded soldiers and dead bodies. Continuing the news from Chongqing.
Now continuing this program, we shall use a few minutes to give our weekly mailbag from Chongqing. The first message is from Miss J. E. Moncrief.
As I was waiting for, believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about eight, just me and my radio. Hey, Miss Behaven, saving all my love for you.
Thank you.
corner, don't go nowhere. What do I care? Your kiss is all worth waiting for. Believe me, baby, I don't stay out late, no place to go. Home about 8, me and my radio, they misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Yes, saving all my love for you.
Thank you, Fast Walt. Friends, if you have a hobby that you think would interest a nationwide radio audience, please write and tell me about it. Write to Dave Ellman, D-A-V-E-E-L-M-A-N, care of the Columbia Broadcasting System, New York City, and when you write about your hobby, be sure to give...
This is our Savior, happier Lord than even we would comprehend. And in these dark days, to know Him who is the light of the world.
John Peel, Jocka Haseldine, and Scott Swahewa Wallace Bled.
Troubled one, that discouraged one, and that sick one, that sick lass, and lassie.
There'll be a man here.
Se fan venir lo tite, i tanghi ammaliato.
Se ci fa incredini,
la musica sospira.
Viva la valserite, viva la valserite, che ci fa divertire.
Concludiamo il nostro programma con un one step, esecuzione dell'orchestra romagnola, diretta dal maestro Casadei.
Imagination. We cannot afford to concentrate entirely on the war in Europe and leave the war in the Pacific in a subordinate position, because the Pacific War is as important as anything going on in the West. Unquote. Dr. Guest urged the need for an Empire War Council, emphasizing the special needs of Australia and New Zealand. Another Labour man, Mr. Patrick Lawrence, referring to Mr. Curtin's article in the Australian press of December 27th, said, quote, "There's no harm in plain speaking. It's proof of Anglo-Australian friendship that there should be plain speaking without any lasting ill feeling or any trouble remaining unsolved." I gather the trouble there has been satisfactorily settled, but the House is entitled to hear what the trouble was about. Unquote. Sir Archibald Southby, Conservative member, said, quote, "Australia has a right to expect that her safety, which is bound up with the possession of Singapore and the maintenance of sea and air power in the Far East, should be guaranteed. Singapore's peril is a peril to Australia and New Zealand. The government will have to listen to criticism from Australia." Unquote. After referring to Australian newspaper articles which accused high officers of vacuous optimism, Sir Archibald Southby continued, quote, "The government has failed to make suitable provision for the defense of Singapore and the Far East. Australia's resentment at the present state of affairs led to Mr. Curtin's article. The article remains ominous and significant, despite efforts made since to whittle it down. Time after time, I've heard Mr. Granville urge in this House the formation of an Imperial War Cabinet. He did not get much encouragement. But the inexorable pressure of events in the Far East has proved him right." Unquote. Sir Percy Harris, Liberal member, said the position in the Far East could be attributed to the absence of coordinated planning. There was an inclination to suggest that the Pacific was a secondary theater of war, but Japan could do irreparable damage both to British material possessions and prestige and to relations with the Dominion, who came to Britain's help in her darkest hour. He continued, quote, "Dominion manpower is limited, and Australia is much exposed to attack. Public men in the Dominion do not always adhere to parliamentary form. They call a spade, and Mr. Curtin spoke the mind of the Australian people. Air Marshal Sir Robert Brooke Popham was brought back from retirement to deal with the most difficult position. I'm not surprised that the people of the Dominion felt that they'd had a raw deal." Unquote. Sir Percy Harris concluded that if an Imperial War Cabinet was important in the last war, it was 10 times more so now, when the life of the Dominions was threatened. Mr. E. Granville, Liberal Nationalist, said, quote, "We were assured there was adequate Imperial consultation, but in view of Mr. Curtin's statements and the magnificent work of Australian troops, we are entitled to a public statement replying to the suggestions made. I am an ex-member of the Australian Imperial Forces, and I say that this great Dominion is entitled to a full say in the direction of the war. Australia has a grievance which has been publicly stated." A message from Canberra tonight says that senior federal ministers are greatly pleased and encouraged by the reports of the debate in the British Parliament, particularly as favourable comments came from all parties in both houses. Prime Minister John Curtin announced in Canberra tonight that arrangements made at Washington in connection with the appointment of General Wavell as Supreme Commander-in-Chief in the Southwest Pacific necessarily bring to an end the mission of the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Mr. Doug Cooper, as resident minister with cabinet rank in Singapore. Mr. Doug Cooper has been asked by the British government to wind up his mission and return home. Important moves to intensify Australia's industrial war effort are announced by the Minister for War Organisation of Industry, John Deadman. Mr. Deadman explains that the production programmes of weapons and munitions could not be fulfilled with labour at present available to war industries, nor would the government's proposals to draw further upon resources of woman power provide all the labour that was required. Consequently, the government would have to divert more and more labour from non-essential production to more urgent war work. Materials, equipment, and factory floor space in such industries must also be made available for war production. The government would exercise a greatly increased control and direction over private enterprise. Mr. Dedman continued, quote, "The government's training scheme will assist the transfer of workers from non-essential industries to war work. This will be carried through as the demand for their services in non-essential industries declines. Where the government proposes to introduce measures of control and direction, advisory committees will be set up consisting of representatives of the management and the employees in each industry." Unquote. Army Minister Ford revealed today the existence of an AIF reserve of thousands of members of the militia forces. This reserve has been established in the last few weeks, and it contains militia men who had previously volunteered for Australian Imperial Force service. When required, they will be transferred, and if necessary, will be available as reinforcements. Mr. Ford said that because of record Australian Imperial Force enlistments, particularly since Japan entered the war, he expected no difficulty in meeting the demand for reinforcements for the Australian Imperial Force in the various theatres of war. Supply Minister Beasley announced today that a draft agreement between the federal government and the Colonial Sugar Refinery for the establishment in each state of power alcohol distilleries using wheat is being prepared. The distilleries would have an output of 3 million gallons a year each. Government authorities explained today that the conversion of wine and spirit distilleries to alcohol fuel production is well advanced in Australia. They were commenting on a cable message that 60% of the United States distilleries had been ordered to divert their plants to industrial alcohol production. Army Minister Ford warned Australians in a national broadcast last night that their fight had barely started. He said it had reached the outer edge of Australia and would come closer still. Nevertheless, the Pacific campaign bristled with awkward technical difficulties for both sides. "We therefore did not necessarily hope for a speedy victory, but victory we would have. Japan, on the other hand, hoped for a speedy victory. Given the utmost exertion by the Allies," added Mr. Ford, "we were confident of our joint power to limit Japan's advance and, somewhat later, to pin her down and teach her a terrible lesson. It might take some time, and we would undoubtedly incur losses, perhaps very heavy losses." The minister went on to say there were many incalculable factors in war, and the balance might at times swing dangerously against us. But Japan could not stem the mighty tide of the incomparable courage of China, the tough, unyielding Dutch, the fierce vitality and pride of race of British peoples throughout the world, and the immense wealth and talent of aroused and angered America. Fresh stories are being told every day of the heroism of guerrilla units operating on commando lines behind the Japanese front in Malaya. In a dispatch from Singapore, Douglas Wilkie of the Melbourne Herald says that among the British troops, apart from Australians who are working on their own somewhere north, is a Nova Scotian who, with five others, stole 6 miles into Thailand on the first day of the war and blew up a police station which was in Japanese hands. Since then, the party has had many adventures, but only three of them are now alive to tell the tale. And that is the end of the news from Australia. Gordon Williams, in this commentary, speaks about the essential unity among the members of the British Commonwealth of Nations. "Widespread interest has been aroused by the statement of Prime Minister John Curtin a few weeks ago, in which he emphasized the primary importance of the Pacific struggle to Australia, and in which he stressed the need for closest cooperation between Australia and America in the job of defeating Japan. Mr. Curtin said that Australia could not accept the dictum that the Pacific struggle must be treated as a subordinate segment of a general conflict. He declared that the Australian government regarded the Pacific struggle as primarily one in which the United States and Australia must have the fullest say in the direction of the democracy's fighting path.
Axis propagandists were quick to seize on the Prime Minister's statement. Laboriously, they tried to alter, distort its meaning. They tried to make it seem that Mr. Curtin's statement meant a split in the fabric of the British Commonwealth, a rift between Australia and Britain. In this, the propagandists were as willfully mendacious as they normally are. Indeed, the debates in the House of Commons and the House of Lords give the lie direct for Axis propaganda. Statements by members of all parties in the British Parliament show quite clearly that the leaders of opinion in every political group in Britain understand and fully appreciate the viewpoint of the Australian Prime Minister. In his statement about the importance of the Pacific War, Mr. Curtin made it clear that the Australian government regarded the war with Japan not as a phase of a struggle with the Axis powers, but as a new war. In saying that his government could not accept the dictum that the Pacific struggle must be treated as a subordinate segment of the general conflict, he made it clear that it wasn't meant that any one of the other theatres of war was of less importance than the Pacific. What was meant was that Australia asked for a concerted plan, invoking the greatest strength at the democracy's disposal, determined upon hurling Japan back. Therefore, he said, the Australian government regarded the Pacific struggle as primarily one in which the United States and Australia must have the fullest say in the direction of the democracy's fighting chance. That statement is quite clear, and its meaning is equally clear. It referred directly to the association of two great democracies in the Pacific, who find themselves warring against a common enemy. Then, to make his intention and his meaning even clearer, Mr. Curtin declared the Australian government's realization of the problems which face the United Kingdom today, among them the constant threat of invasion and dangers of dispersal of strength. Only the ill-intentioned, the mischief-makers, the fifth colonists, the Axis propagandists, could read into the Australian Prime Minister's declaration any hint of British Commonwealth disunity. The British parliamentary debate, once and for all, shows that British opinion shares the Australian Prime Minister's view. It reveals, too, the essential unity of the British Commonwealth on those vital and fundamental matters that control the welfare of our historic group of nations. There's no cleavage between Australia and Britain, or between Australia and any other part of the Commonwealth. We know now that whether we fight today in the Pacific, or the Mediterranean, or the Atlantic, we are fighting for the one purpose: to preserve our liberty and live our lives as we want to live them. It is possible that from time to time Australians may disagree with other parts of the Commonwealth about the method of conducting this war. But there'll never be any disagreement about the need, the vital need to win the war, or about the urgent duty now laid on every free man and woman to make every sacrifice demanded for victory. This is Australia calling.